This is going to be another two-parter, I'll just warn you. There's too much stuff to cover in one Sunday morning, but it's one idea, so that the idea needs to be kept together. You trying to find somebody, Carol? We're looking for a parent, I'll bet. Did the battery go dead in your buzzer or something? Okay, we'll take care of it. Is John back there crying again in the nursery? The big baby. Anyway, John, you know, he talks about sin and he talks about love and he talks about sin and he talks about love, and he's writing to these second, third generation Christians who are being influenced by the world, sucked into the lie of Gnosticism and another kind of weird thing called Docetism. And the bottom line of, or I guess one of the bottom lines of both of those, is the idea that Jesus was not God in the flesh. And that's, you know, not an uncommon idea today. There's all kinds of weird explanations and stories for who Jesus really was or must have been or could have been or had to be and all that stuff. But, you know, the Bible's real clear, and then John, in 1 John, he kind of makes it his mission in life to make the point irrefutably, or at least make the claim that this is what Christianity believes, you know, and of course it is true, that Jesus is God in the flesh. You know, he wasn't someone who, just a man, and then the Spirit came on him at one point in his life at that baptism by John the Baptist. And then, you know, later on in his life at the cross, the Spirit kind of jumped back off of him, you know, and he was Christ in the middle, but on the edges, he was just a guy. And that's, you know, that's just nonsense. According to the Bible, according to the Spirit of God who inspired these men to put pen to paper and write these ideas down, those ideas just are not in the realm of possibility and really not worthy of consideration or discussion. You know, it always worries me. There's kind of a fad going on these days. There's always some fad cycling around the church, but the fad these days is this thing where church becomes a discussion. The whole purpose of gathering and of believers getting together is to be open to discussion for anything. And we'll talk about maybe there is no Trinity, or maybe Jesus wasn't God, and maybe, you know, this and maybe that. Maybe God didn't create the world the way the Word says he does, and honest science actually concludes he did. But there's all these discussions going on, and every once in a while someone will invite me into one of these discussions. Usually over the internet, sometimes around a coffee table, but they just don't get too far with me. I'm not interested in discussing what might be true. I'm a lot more interested in exploring what we know to be true. And John lays it out here about the love of God, and about the reality of sin, and about the person of Jesus, the God-man. Not 50-50, not 60-40, not part-time man, part-time God, but 100% God and 100% man. And he's going to make that point again here in these first few verses of chapter 5 of 1 John. But before we get into the text, let me ask you this. This is a rhetorical question. Don't answer it out loud or everybody will look funny at you. But if you were going to describe your faith, you know, if you were going to tell somebody, you know, that you're a Christian, how do you say it? Or what would you say? You know, do you say that you know God? Would you say that you received the Lord, or that you accepted Jesus into your heart? You know, how would you actually say it? Are you born again? Are you born from above? Are you set free? Are you brand new? You know, which term? Do you call yourself a believer? Or do you call yourself a disciple, or a true disciple, or real disciple? Do you call yourself a Jesus follower? You know, or a fully devoted follower, a DFD, like one of the churches have popularized here lately? Excuse me. Maybe You're here this morning, you don't really have a relationship with the Lord, so you don't call it anything. You never really had to think about what to call it. You know, you're not sure even what it means. How do you have a relationship with a guy, someone that, okay, he was real, but that was 2,000 years ago? And what do they mean when they say, you know, we're going to meet the Lord, or you're going to know the Lord? Well, whether you've only just met the Lord, maybe you're a new believer, you know, wet behind the ears spiritually. Maybe you've known the Lord for years. Maybe you've known the Lord, you know, it seems like forever, as long as you can remember. Or if you're one of those who don't know him at all, these first three verses of John, 1 John chapter 5, clarify exactly what it means to have a relationship with God. And in this passage, John is going to use the term born of God. And we'll look at it a little closer in a minute. You could translate it born from God, because that's really the intent or the meaning. Then he uses three words to sum up what it means to be born of God. He tells us that to be born of God is to believe, to love, and to obey. So we're going to read the first three verses here, and then today we're really going to focus on verse 1, and then next week we'll finish out with verses 2 and 3. Here we are, 1 John 5, verse 1. Whoever believes that Jesus is the Christ is born of God, and everyone who loves him who begot also loves him who is begotten of him. By this we know that we love the children of God when we love God and keep his commandments. For this is the love of God, that we keep his commandments. His commandments are not burdensome. Okay, three words describe this thing called being born of God. And the first one is believe. Whoever believes. It's the Greek word pistuo. I don't think that's the right pronunciation, but I'm going to go with it today. It's the same root word as the word translated faith. Okay, so you get an idea there. Now, the tense of this, whoever believes, is whoever is believing would be probably a more grammatically correct or full translation. It's an active believing, a continuous, ongoing believing. Also, there are some scholars, or at least one that I can name, whose research has, he's concluded that this believing is actually a believing that is the result of being born of God. Now, we're going to come back to that idea, because some of you are going, wait a minute now, it sounds kind of, you know, Calvinistic to me. Just hold your horses, buckle your seatbelt, we're going to be fine. But when we flesh that idea out, I think you'll see that it makes a lot of sense. There is a moment when you first believe. You know, you've kind of lived your own way for a season, and whether you're 7 or 17 or 75, you reach that point. One day, somehow, some way, it occurs to you that, you know, Dr. Phil's right. This ain't working for me. And so you turn to one thing or another, finally, ultimately, somehow you turn your mind, your heart, your thoughts, your attention to the things of God, God of the Bible, Jesus of the Bible, and the Bible itself. Maybe someone shares with you. Someone has a little tract that they pull out, and instead of hitting them over the head with your umbrella, you actually let them show it to you. Or you watch somebody on Christian TV, and yeah, their hair's piled up to here, but, you know, they're making sense. And on the radio, maybe, or you read a book, or, you know, somehow the information comes your way, and there's something inside of you that kind of resonates, and it goes, man, I get this. This is making sense to me. I've been trying my whole life now to kind of do things my own way and do what I think is right. And occasionally I kind of blow it, but nothing too bad. And, you know, even when I did do something really bad, it was just for a minute. And, you know, I'm okay. I'm going to be all right. But now you're realizing, you know, I can't help myself. I'm always going to get sucked back into those desires, those cravings of the flesh to have and to get and experience and enjoy, and it's always going to lead me into trouble. And now, finally, someone's telling me, or I'm discovering for myself, that God has a way to, first of all, forgive me of the wrong things I've done so that I get a completely clean slate. I'm brand new. And I'm born again. I'm born of God, born from God. If I just put my faith, you know, Jesus went to the cross and took my sin away. I'm forgiven. I'm accepted. I'm loved. I'm included. You know, I'm embraced. I'm invited to come boldly to the throne of grace, and God loves me and looks forward to seeing me, and he's not mad at me, and he's not out to get me like a fly on the counter, you know, and that all makes sense in that moment, that day, that time. And there's an instant where you put your faith in Jesus Christ. You jump in. I'm going for it. I believe it. Jesus was born of a virgin, lived a sinless life, died a substitutionary death for my sin, was buried and rose to new life 3 days later, and I'm born again and I'm brand new. And there's that moment when that happens, man, and it's just so awesome. There's a song, you know, wash me in your river of love, make me feel brand new. And it does feel brand new, and it feels good. It's like having that shower when you're all grungy and been driving in the car for 3 days or something. You know what I mean? It just feels good. Now, there is that moment that, you know, that's part of it, when you accept God's invitation to put your faith, and you're saved and you're sealed and you're filled and it's all good. But believing doesn't end there. With that one time, first time kind of decision and you know, putting your faith in him. You know, someone says, are you a Christian? You go, well, yeah, I am. Well, what makes you a Christian? Well, 30 years ago, I came forward at a service. Not according to John. That's how you became a Christian. Maybe it's a subtle distinction in the language. It's how you became a Christian, but that's not what makes you a Christian right here and right now. What makes you a Christian right here and right now is this believing. Whoever believes, not whoever believed one day 30 years ago at a crusade, but whoever is right now continuously, actively, constantly believing. A person who's born of God is a person who's believing, not just a person who believed once, one time, one day. Now, this verse says that everyone who believes, and that's that whoever, everyone, you know, anyone, whoever believes that Jesus is the Christ is, and here's the key words, born of God. Whoever believes is born of God. So, let's dig a little deeper into what does it mean to be believing actively, the way this verb is the way the grammar of it kind of insists that we understand it. What does it mean to be believing actively? Now, my English dictionary has four definitions for the English word believe, and really all four of them fit pretty good. The first one is to accept, you know, to receive or be persuaded, and that fits when it comes to faith in the Lord. The second definition is anticipate. To look forward to expectantly. Well, when I say I believe in Jesus, that encompasses, includes that idea that I'm looking expectantly, confidently. I'm not just hoping he comes. I know he's coming, and I've kind of got one eye out for it all the time. The third definition of believe, to argue in the sense of defend. You know, I believe, and I'm going to defend that belief. I'm going to provide the proof, the evidence, you know. I think it's Paul that says, be ready to give an answer all the time, you know, to everybody. Who's that guy, Little is his last name, who wrote a book about that? Know why, what you believe and why you believe it. So accept, anticipate, argue, and in the fourth definition in my English dictionary is assume, which means to take for granted that a thing is true. Now apply those to an active, living, continuous faith in Jesus Christ. It means I'm persuaded. It means I look forward expectantly. It means I'm ready to defend my belief. And I just assume and take for granted that a thing is true. Now, the opposite of this kind of believing is what we find in James chapter 1. Look, we just went through James not too long ago. Turn back just a few pages. James, yes, you get back before John, you got a couple of Peters, and then you got a James. And right in chapter 1 at verse 5, and this is one of those passages that Bible people are familiar with, and even not Bible people sometimes can't help but rub up against this one. James chapter 1 and verse 5, where he says, "If any of you lacks wisdom, let him ask of God, who gives liberally and without reproach, and it will be given to him. But let him ask in faith." Same word, you know, same root word. "Let him ask believing, with no doubting." See, it's the believing is the opposite of doubt. "Let him ask without doubting, for he who doubts is like a wave of the sea, driven and tossed by the wind. For let not that man," the one who doubts, "suppose that he'll receive anything from the Lord." See, now this passage in James, he's talking about a prayer asking for wisdom. You know, and if you believe you'll receive the wisdom, then you will receive the wisdom. And if you don't believe it, you ain't going to get nothing. You know, is the kind of the bottom line there. He's talking about prayer here, but the principle carries over into this here. Whoever believes is born of God. Whoever believes and doesn't doubt. I think it's interesting that James says, let the one who doubts, he says it funny, so I can't remember it, but, you know, let him not think he will receive anything. Doubt. Put it another way, the one who is not believing is not born of God. "But I came forward at the revival. I went to the crusade. You know, I cried and walked down the aisle while the organ played, or I came down while the banjo got, you know, whatever. I remember and I went down." But he's not talking about that one time receiving, accepting. He's talking about this continuing, active, constant belief that is the opposite of doubt. If you don't believe, you're not born of God. That's kind of a scary thought. To believe, to believe actively, it means to act outwardly on what you believe inwardly. See, to act out, not just to kind of sit on the faith one time, one day, but to, you know, you go to the gas station when the gas gauge goes down to E because you believe that they're going to have gas down there. And unless you were around for a couple of years in the 70s, they always do, pretty much. You plant seeds in your garden or your flower bed because you believe they're going to grow. You don't just hope they'll grow. "Well, I hope this works out." They might. No, no, you believe it or you wouldn't go to all that trouble. You pray because you believe that God hears your prayer. And if you didn't believe that, then again, why bother? See, those are actions based on what you believe, based on believing. The Bible says that those who are believing, those who are acting outwardly on what they believe inwardly, are born of God. So that kind of begs the next question. What must we believe, or what belief must we act on to be born of God, to have a relationship with God? And now we get down to the heart of John's intent for even saying this. Verse 1 tells us that whoever believes that Jesus is the Christ is born of God. Little side note, inductive Bible study students, you see how that works? Whoever believes is born of God. What do you have to believe? Believe that Jesus is the Christ. Remember, we're not talking about that one-time agreement with the fact that Jesus is the Christ. We're talking about active believing, a believing that is expressed or revealed outwardly. To put it another way, to be born of God means that your thoughts, your words, your actions are influenced by your believing that Jesus is the Christ. Now, that's a lot of stuff tied together. Let's kind of break it down a little bit. What exactly does it mean that Jesus is the Christ? Okay, we can split that into two parts. First of all, we're talking about Jesus. We're talking about the man who was known historically as Jesus of Nazareth. We know that he was born in Bethlehem right around 2,000 years ago. We're getting ready to celebrate Christmas, and it always kind of, I don't know, it tickles me that the only thing that the scholars agree on is that Jesus probably wasn't born December 25th. You know, there's a whole sort of route you can trace to how that date ever got established. And, it's fine with me. I think we ought to celebrate his birth every day. And that's what I tell the Jehovah's Witnesses when they come to my door and try to make a big point of it. You know, well, he wasn't born on Christmas. And I go, well, I know that. You know, I agree with you, but he was born. Let's have a party. You know, give me a present. I'll give you one. Well, it doesn't matter what day it is, but Jesus of Nazareth, born in Bethlehem about 2,000 years ago at the time of the census ordered by Caesar Augustus. That is a historical fact. You know, it's in the Bible, but it's also outside of the Bible, and extra-biblical sources will confirm the date of that census. His mother's name was Mary. His stepfather was a man named Joseph. He was born, he lived, he ate, he drank, he worked, he slept, and all the rest that people do when they live here on planet Earth. We're not talking about a mythical character that symbolizes man's eternal quest, you know, to become one with the universal Dada or some crazy thing. We're talking about an actual, factual, historical figure, a man named Jesus. And second of all, he's the Christ. Whoever believes that Jesus is the Christ. Seems like it wasn't that long ago since we kind of talked about this. Christ is not Jesus' last name, nor is it the second half of a popular expression of frustration. It's really not. Christ is a title. He's Jesus the Christ. And we understand that Christ is a Greek word which literally means the anointed one. That's why it's very specific. You know, the definite article for you Bible students, he is the Christ, not a Christ. It's not Jesus is Christ or a Christ. He's the Christ. He's the specific, the one, the anointed one, which is a term that goes back, the Greek translation of the Hebrew word Messiah. We'll look more at that in a minute. Turn back to Matthew chapter 16, talking about Jesus is the Christ. First book in the New Testament. If you get to Malachi, you've gone too far. The names in the New Testament are much easier to pronounce. You know, Luke, Peter, Matt. You know, I like that. Isaiah, 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 you know, I mean, it can get complicated. But here we are in the good old New Testament, Matthew chapter 16, verse 15. Again, Bible students will recognize what's going on here. Well, let's back up to verse 13. Jesus came into the region of Caesarea Philippi. He's up at the top of the hill there, the headwaters of the Jordan coming down out of that granite cliff. He asked his disciples, "Who do men say that I, the Son of Man, am?" It's funny, he just told them who he was when he asked them who he was. Or who do others say that the Son of Man, using that title from Daniel chapter 7, the Son of Man am? And so they said, "Well, some say you're John the Baptist. Some say you're Elijah, and others Jeremiah or one of the prophets." And we've been through this before. That's kind of the best they could figure out. And he said to them, "But who do you say that I am?" You know, first it's, who does everybody else say that I am? Now you 12 guys who have lived with me and walked with me and prayed with me and worshiped with me and ministered with me, you 12, who do you say? after all of our experiences, after all the teaching? Who do you say that I am? And it's Peter. I can't wait to meet Peter. I think I'm going to be embarrassed for making fun of him so much. You know, Peter, the apostle with the foot-shaped mouth, you know, stuff like that. Talk first and think later. I think, you know, I'm probably sorry. And Peter answered him. Who do you say I am? Peter answered him. Here it is. You are the Christ, the anointed one, the Messiah, the Son of the living God. And Jesus answered and said to him, blessed are you, Simon Barjona, for flesh and blood has not revealed this to you, but my Father who is in heaven. Jesus is the Christ. And John says, whoever believes that Jesus is the Christ is born of God. And that just kind of stands to reason logically that whoever does not believe or whoever doubts that Jesus is the Christ is not born of God. Now, again, Christ, that Greek translation for the word Messiah. By the way, the word Messiah occurs twice untranslated in the New Testament. Usually it's translated Christ. John uses it twice and without translating it, talking about Messiah. And it is from, let's turn to Daniel chapter 9. Now, this is that awesome prophecy that Daniel gave. I'm drawing a blank. 600 years ahead of time? A long time, okay, before it was fulfilled. And starting in verse 25, here's Daniel speaking. Know, therefore, and understand that from the going forth of the command to restore and build Jerusalem until Messiah, that's the word we're looking for, the prince, there shall be 7 weeks and 62 weeks. The street shall be built again and the wall, even in troublesome times. And after 62 weeks, Messiah will be cut off, but not for himself. And the people of the prince who is to come shall destroy the city and the sanctuary. The end of it shall be with a flood until the end of the war. Desolations are determined. Now, this is a whole couple of Sunday mornings all unto itself. But what's going on here is that Daniel, speaking under the inspiration of the Holy Spirit, is writing things that I just kind of wonder, I doubt if he knew exactly what the fulfillment was going to look like. But from the going forth of the command to restore and build Jerusalem, well, a while back we studied through Nehemiah and we found that date. It's in the annals of history. I can't recall it off the top of my head, but there is a date recorded when King, I think it's Artaxerxes, gave the command to rebuild. So we have a start date. And he says there shall be 7 weeks and 62 weeks. Now we understand a week to be a week of years, 7 years. So 7 and 62 is 69 periods of 7 years. And the street shall be built again, the wall, talking about Jerusalem there, even in troublesome times. And after the 62 weeks, okay, after 62 periods of 7 years, and then if you really want to get technical, you have to go back and do a 360-day calendar, because that's what the calendar that Daniel had in mind when he said this. And you count the days and the years, you know, 62 times 7 times 360, and you come to the day Jesus marched into Jerusalem. We call it the triumphal entry on a donkey's colt. And it said, after those 62 weeks, on that day, Messiah will be cut off. And that's what happened when they crucified him. But not for himself. And the people of the prince who is to come shall destroy the city and the sanctuary. Probably a reference to Titus and the Romans that came and destroyed everything there. And the end of it shall be with a flood until the end of the war. Desolations are determined. And then we could keep going, but it'd be a whole different topic. So we'll stop right there. Making the point that Jesus is the Messiah. You know, Jesus actually held the Jews accountable. He said to them in the Gospels, you can hunt this down. He said, because you didn't recognize me, Jerusalem's going to be destroyed, and that's the very destruction that's part of this same prophecy. See, they should have known, and they did know. Born of a virgin, born Bethlehem Ephrata, out of you will come, you know, descendant of the son of David, the son of man. All the clues were there, and they knew the clues, and they kind of knew, but they didn't want to believe he was who he was. You know, they weren't going to believe that Jesus is the Christ. They weren't going to be born of God. The Christ is not a spirit or a power or a consciousness that comes on you or that you achieve, although there are those that would teach that. It's an interesting idea. I guess it's kind of fun. It's like flying a kite. You know, it doesn't get you anywhere. But the problem is the text does not allow that interpretation. That's a fantasy. That is called eisegesis. It's reading your ideas into the text instead of reading exegesis, reading God's ideas out of the text. Only one individual could ever be the Christ, and that individual is Jesus. Now, when the full impact of that truth takes root in your head, in your thinking, in your intellect, in your understanding, and when the roots make their way down into your heart, it changes everything. It changes everything. You wake up in the morning and it's a new world. It's the same old lumpy mattress and the same old view out the window, but you know what? It's all new. It changes everything. Knowing, believing, understanding, and actively believing that Jesus is the Christ, it changes your perspective. It changes your perspective on life and death and love and hate and heaven and hell and good and bad and everything else. It just changes your perspective. It changes your priorities. It changes what is important to you and what is not important. Sometimes it just flips them. It changes what you perceive as having value and what you perceive as having no value. And my friends who've been through some sort of addiction and recovery, you know exactly what I'm talking about. Because what was once the goal of life, first thing every morning, to get stoned or hammered or drunk or buy some or sell some or get some and be one, you know, all of a sudden that's the least important thing. It just turns all your priorities upside down. You want to get to the top of the business world. Well, that's a worthy goal and it's a project to work on, but it no longer becomes the most important thing that keeps me breathing. It becomes kind of, how can I express my faith? By being an honest business person and doing good work and charging a fair price and, you know, all that kind of stuff. It changes your perspective. It changes your priorities. It changes your performance. And by performance, I mean just the way you live. See, understanding and believing that Jesus is the Christ, it changes your performance because you come to realize it's not your performance that determines your relationship with God. It's your believing. It's my acting on my belief, not acting on I want to believe. If I act right, then God will. No. And when you get a handle on who Jesus is, he's the Christ. He's Jesus from Nazareth, the anointed one of God. It changes that. It's kind of like when you go on a diet. Now, I really don't know anything about that, but when you go on a diet, you know, you read a book or you get a magazine article and you go, here's what you have to eat this and you can't eat that and you get all this rules and regulations and then all you can think about is food. Oh, no cake? Oh, I never wanted a cake so bad in my life. You know what? No more peanuts? Forget it. Throw that book away. You know, I'm not going for that. It's all you can think about and it's like, that's how it is when your relationship with God is based on your performance. All you can think about is all the stuff I can't do. I'm in a straitjacket. The Lord loves me so much, he's going to tie me down like Gulliver and the little people, you know? I can't move. No, that's not the way it works at all. But when we go there. When we put the performance first, that's what it becomes for us. And all we can think about are the things we can't do. I heard a guy talking last night about the difference between, we think that we're set apart from stuff. You know, I can't do this and I can't do that. I'm a Christian now. I'm a believer. I'm born of God. I'm a child of God. And so there's this list of things that I can't do. I kind of miss them. My old friends over there, you know, in the closet. I can't throw the stuff out, but I keep the door locked, you know, kind of a thing. But no, we're set apart to, or unto would be the correct word. We're not set apart from stuff. We're set apart to stuff. It's kind of like, you know, when you got married, you were set apart to that person, and that should be your focus. Your focus isn't all the wonderful guys and gals that are no longer available because you got married. But that's what we turn it into, and we turn our life being born of God into all the things I can't do. And he says, no, look what you can do. Look who Jesus is. Look what you've received. Look what it means to be born of God and a child of God, to be forgiven and set free and renewed and restored and redeemed and all the rest of that stuff, and look forward to an eternity that is, you know, I like that song, I Can Only Imagine, except it should be called You Can't Even Imagine. The worst day in heaven is better than the best day you can imagine. It changes everything. To be born of God means that you believe. That's the first word. The second word is love. We've been talking about that quite a bit lately. Whoever believes that Jesus is the Christ is born of God, and everyone who loves him who begot, that is the Father, who Jesus is the only begotten Son of, also loves him who is begotten of him. That's you. That's me. Those are the people that are born of God through believing. See, believing God is inextricably tied to loving God. You can't believe him and not love him. You can't love him and not be believing in him. The relationship we have with God as we are believing actively, continuously, constantly, is a relationship of love. It's not a relationship of rules. It's not a relationship of wrath. It's not a relationship of threats. It's a relationship of love. If believing is the basis of our being born of God, then loving is the purpose. That's what it's all about. I'm in this thing because I'm believing in God, but then what that does to me and what I do with that is love. It turns me into a loving person. Look just back here in 1 John on the same page, maybe verse 4:19. We talked about this last week. We love him because he first loved us. We spent the last 2 weeks explaining the meaning of agape love, the God kind of love, the deliberate decision to care, the unconditional love and acceptance that is God's nature. That means he welcomes you and includes you, not because of anything about you, but in spite of everything about you and me. God created man, you know, in the beginning. He created man so that he could enjoy fellowship. He can enjoy a love relationship with us. But at the fall, that fellowship was broken. And we understand that from Genesis chapter 2 and 3. But the relationship was broken. God's love wasn't broken. God's ability to love, God's desire to love, God's nature to love, that wasn't undone by the fall of man in the garden. God has engineered and enacted a plan that will restore the fellowship that was broken in the garden. And even though it required the sacrifice of his son, he did it, he does it, because he loves us. And we love him because he first loved us. Now, as we are believing, as we are investing our faith in those truths, who Jesus is and God's love for us, the full impact of that reality hits us, of being born of God. And then it's like it's like a dam burst. You know, the floodgates are opened, and the love that we've wanted so desperately to release finally has a home for the first time. Isn't it true that all of our lives we search for someone to love? Someone who won't disappoint us, someone who won't betray us. I have a friend who wrote a song. It's called, we go on, eye to eye and face to face. It's about being a single guy and just every girl that comes along, not because he's some lust-crazed animal, but because his heart wants a partner and just looking from, are you the one? Is it you? Are you the one? Eye to eye, face to face. And that really is just the nature of our existence, because there's this love within us that desperately wants an object, you know, to love. When I lived in Nashville for a while, I hung out with some songwriters, and there were basically two kinds of songs, love songs, I should say, two categories of love songs. One was the love song that was about the person, the object of the love. Never forget, my buddy went to a writing session at one of the publishing houses, and they wrote this song called Our Love is Out of Control. And here's the chorus. Honey, sweetie, baby, you're so good looking. Our love is like a pot of chili cooking. True story. Real song. How many songs are about, you know, you're the one, look, you know, the look, the sense, the love, the experience. And then category number two of those Nashville songwriters is about the one that's, you know, so aching, so seeking, so, don't you want somebody to love? Don't you need, you know, and those are the two categories. Well, there's a lot of reality to that. We feel that way about people because there's something inside of us as we just, it's part of our nature that love within us wants an object. It wants, you know, to be expressed, and we look for someone who won't betray our trust, someone who won't neglect us, abuse us, disappoint us, hurt us, let us down. And, you know, in the flesh, good luck with that. You know, if you found that, then, man, put yourself on the short list of the fortunate few, because most people, you know, we let each other down. That's because that's what we are and what we do. But when you're born of God, we have now Jesus as the object. He's the sponge that can soak up all that love that's just been exploding to come out of our soul. And he'll never betray you. He'll never leave you or forsake you, says Hebrews, I think. He's the one that we can love safely. And when we can love him, like it says here in John, everyone who loves him who begot, when you love God, also loves him who is begotten of him. See, that love becomes horizontal. Because God loves me, I love him. And because I love him, I love everybody else who's born of God. Only those who are born of God, believers in Jesus Christ, can ever experience the fulfillment of loving so freely. Man, that's something we have on the world, and they just don't get that. If I just find the right guy or the right gal, sorry. I mean, I hope you come close, and even in the church, you know, you find a spirit-filled guy and a spirit-filled gal, and they put God first, and they're, you know, they're moving, they're, as they both move towards God, they're actually getting closer together, and that's the way it's supposed to work. But even in that relationship, there's nothing like that soul-to-soul, spirit-to-spirit love connection that is available to those who are born of God through believing in Jesus Christ. Believing God is inextricably tied to loving God, and loving God is inextricably tied to loving God's kids. That's the horizontal aspect we talked about. When it says, him who is begotten of him, the NIV just says it a lot clearer. It talks about his child, and, you know, everyone who loves his child, you know, those born of God, you know, all those born of God through faith, through believing, And what he's telling us is that God's children all love one another because they all love God. That's the thing we have in common that unites us more than anything else. You can go to the same school, you can have the same parents, you can grow up in the same house, and you can be next door neighbors, and you can be tight, you can be close, you can be like that. But it's nothing compared to the connection. That's what fellowship is, koinonia, share between people who are loved by God and love God, because then we love one another. In fact, according to this verse, if we don't love one another, it shows that we don't really love God. Follow the logic here. If we don't love one another, we don't really love God. And if we don't really love God, that means we're not really believing. And if we're not really believing, then we haven't been born of God. And if we haven't been born of God, we're no different than the rest of the world. So put on your party hat and woo, you know, because that's about all you got to look forward to. Relationship to relationship, disappointment to disappointment, frustrating, you know, hopes dashed, and that whole cycle. That's what the world has. The first word was believe, to believe, to be believing. To be born of God means that you believe that Jesus is the Christ. The second word, love. To be born of God means that you love God and you love God's children. Now, there's one more word that we haven't looked at that may be the most important word in these first three verses. Have to ask, to whom is all this available? You know, whoever believes, who's he talking about there? Who can believe God? Who can be born of God? Who can love God? And who can love God's children? The very first word, whoever. I think the NIV just says everyone. Anyone. Even you. Even me. No one is excluded. This is an unconditional, open invitation to all. Now, that third word, next week we're going to pick it up in verse 2, and we're going to see how believing and loving fit in with obeying. He uses a couple of times the phrase here, keep his commandments. And I know what you're thinking. I knew there was a catch. Sounded too good to be true, and when it sounds too good to be true, it usually is. I know there's a line that I'm supposed to toe up to. There's a thing I'm supposed to march in order, and I'm supposed to follow the rules and all the rest, and, you know, I'll come back next Sunday. I think you'll be pleasantly surprised. Let's pray.